Hello and welcome to the Cycling Science Podcast, episode number 15, incorporation of 30-second sprints into your endurance ride. I'm your host, Professor Richard Davison. For those of you who are new to this podcast, we aim to dive into the latest research on all aspects of cycling, usually by interviewing the author of a recent published paper. These interviews give us an opportunity to dig a bit deeper into the research itself, put the paper into context, and end up with some practical takeaway messages. As the podcast is all about translation of research and recent innovation, we also occasionally interview top-level practitioners or discuss topics that have come up recently in the cycling press. In this episode, I interview Dr. Nikki Winfield-Almquist, who is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. We discuss one of his publications, The Effect of 30-Second Sprints During Prolonged Exercise on Gross Efficiency, Electromyography, and Pedaling Technique in Elite Cyclists. This is published in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance in 2019. This paper is one of the studies in his PhD, and thus our discussion does expand to include some of his other work. Okay, today I would like to welcome Nikki Almquist. I hope I'm saying that right, Nikki, but I'm sure you'll correct me in a moment, but Nikki's currently a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Copenhagen, and the subject of our interview today is around one of Nikki's papers, but we'll broaden that out a little bit later on. But the paper is The Effect of 30-Second Sprints During Prolonged Exercise on Gross Efficiency, Electromyography, and Pedaling Technique in Elite Cyclists. This was published in 2019 in the International Journal of Sports Physiology and Performance. So first of all, welcome, Nikki, and could you just tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves?
Yeah, thank you, Richard. So as you said, I'm a postdoc. It's at the Department of Nutrition, Exercise, and Sports. So I've kind of switched focus to a more molecular physiology focus at the moment. I did my PhD at University Inland, Norway, under the supervision of Bent Rønnestad and Øyvind Sandbach. And that was much more focused on elite cycling. So my PhD was on generally the effects of including sprints in prolonged cycling sessions in elite cyclists. And this paper we're going to start off with today is the first paper we published where we look at what happens when you include sprints during a four-hour cycling session.
Okay. So just generally a little bit about yourself, Nikki. You're a cyclist yourself, I take it.
Yeah, you know, when you first get into cycling in the scientific manner, you also get a bit curious to see, well, what is it these crazy dudes are actually doing? So I just started cycling when I started my PhD in 2016, and been competing in the primarily ultra ultra cycling competitions, so for 500 kilometer races. Recently I just moved to Denmark, started my PhD postdoc position here, University of Copenhagen. So now I'm just an ordinary cyclist with an ordinary license.
That's interesting. I think it's interesting that way around, as you say. I suppose scientists, I think we're always very curious beings, and I think particularly when we, I suppose, put people in a lab and we try to subject them to pain, we go, maybe we should try this ourselves. I suppose it sucks you in, doesn't it? I suppose I reflect on my background. I was a cyclist first before I was ever a scientist, but then My experience, sports science was very, very new when I was good doing my training. So it's maybe slightly different. Well, it's a lot different these days. We've a lot more people who are studying sports science and doing PhDs. So
indeed. Actually, I was a national elite rower in Denmark. Been on the national team for a couple of years. So my curiosity in elite sports was pretty much why I got into sports science to begin with. But I actually think that coming as a non-cyclist and try to investigate things, you ask different questions than you do when you are totally rolled into cycling. So I asked a lot of questions that nobody in the community didn't to begin with. And a lot of the questions were, of course, stupid, but some of them were more based on this is how we do it because we've always done it this way. And I was the guy who asked, but why? Are you doing that? So this is kind of the beginning of why I started on research in cycling.
Good. I suppose I know we chatted a little bit before the interview itself, but I reflect on my own experience, and I think one of the reasons for having the podcast is exactly to ask these questions, I've been steeped in it for nearly 50 years. And grew up with it. My father was a cyclist, and so therefore, initially I was one of those people who you spoke to other people in the cycling club, and they told you this is how it is. But I suppose as a scientist, I think it is that idea of continually asking the questions. But like me as well, as I'm also a coach, so I also recognize that there are many things in science that we can't answer, or we don't yet have the answers, and the coaches have the experience and they know about individual responses. They've learned over many years how to get the best out of their athletes, and we yet don't necessarily have something that we could document in hard facts and numbers to say why that's better than others. But I think, and this is, I suppose, one of the great things about your sort of paper, is it kind of takes some of the, maybe the practices that have been there and starts to fill in some of the evidence behind it. So was that part, I'm actually quite curious, the stimulus for this particular study and the, I suppose, the direction of your PhD, what was it that got you down this route?
Yeah, it was rather basic observation. Since I came from rowing in Denmark, we have a history of not spending so much time in the low intensity zones in rowing. We usually have shorter sessions with high intensity, and on a general basis, I really hated those long sessions. For me, 1 hour would be a long session. So I was just looking at cycling and thinking, How are these guys doing 4, 6, 7, 8 hours on the bike and not boring themselves to death? And my thought of doing something fun is sprinting at that moment. Crazy at my scene. So it actually most of all started with the curious question. Why couldn't we improve that low intensity session in some way by including some sprints and also have a sort of more fun session? I guess if you do 20 hours on the bike every week at low intensity, it could be rather boring. So why not spice it up a bit? That was the layman question I started with. But also, as I mentioned before we started recording, I did my master thesis in sprinting in runners. And we found some very profound, huge effects on running performance, 10 kilometer running performance, when you only perform sprint training. And the molecular background for that, or some of the molecular mechanisms underlying that, I thought would have translatability to cycling as well. And also, if you look at cycling as a sport, it's not how much power you're able to put down for 8 hours makes up who wins at the end. It's, do you have the power enough to either break away or just follow a breakaway to be in the right positions? So in my thought, repeated sprint training should be something that cyclists spend more time on. So that's a basic, curious questions I had to begin with.
And I suppose there is the background of, as you'll be aware, in recent years, there has been an explosion of research just looking at, sprint training across the whole spectrum. Obviously, if you were an athlete, I suppose similarly, reflecting back to your rowing, I'm sure you had sessions where it was short, sharp bursts of sprint interval training. So interval training is not new in itself. But the idea of for a particular even untrained people to do it, and even now clinical populations where we do sprint training and trying to understand what the physiological response has to that, there has been an explosion in information and research. So we are obviously a bit more aware of what the physiological impact of that is. So you were curious about, spicing up boring rides, but also aware of the potential physiological impact of sprint training. Now, of course, I suppose maybe what a lot of cyclists would have done would have had these separate, maybe in separate sessions. So they'd still have had their sprint session. They would have done intervals, and then they would have done maybe a longer ride in another day. But this was, I suppose, the concept of putting these together.
Yeah, exactly. Just appreciating that cyclists already do at least 15 hours, preferably 20 to 30 hours a week. I thought, okay, just having one session with or two sessions a week with sprint training takes a lot of the time away from all the other stuff that we might not have the best argument for doing, but we do it. And apparently, if you take away a lot of the low intensity sessions, it would have a negative effect on the cyclist. So I thought I could not persuade anyone to swap the low intensity sessions for sprint sessions. And I don't think that it would be preferable to do it either. So that's why I thought of, okay, maybe we could put them together and see, does it have any effects on the recovery as well? For instance, would it take more time to recover from those kind of sessions?
I suppose the other element in the background as well is in terms of other research that might point towards this type of training would be, the sort of the polarized or pyridymal type, model where, sort of reading between the lines and what you said about your own rowing training, that was probably very much in if we use the sort of critical power model, the sort of zone two, middle zone intensity up to sort of anaerobic threshold or maximum lactate steady state, that type of intensity, rather than this idea that we have, exercise intensity in the domains at either end and we don't do anything in the middle or we do much less in the middle.
Yeah.
I suppose the idea this session really is a polarized session, I suppose, if you want to put it that
as polarized as it gets, I guess.
Okay, let's just delve into a little bit of the detail of this particular study and just sort of go through who were your participants and what did they have to do and what type of measurements were you interested in, and I suppose why are these measurements sort of, I suppose, important in terms of cycling performance?
So we recruited 12 elite male cyclists. So these are guys who are competing at the national level. So they are some of the best in Norway at that time, and some of them are in the middle somewhere of the of elite cyclists. So they are not world tour level, but the level below, I would say. Generally, if you can put it like that, it's VO2 max around 73. So they are fairly well trained, I would say, and a maximal aerobic power of 6.3 watts per kilo. So these are, yeah, well-trained guys. They don't exercise as much, and this is mainly because this study was done in, not in the off season, but in the beginning of the preparatory period, as I recall it. So this is the indoor time in Norway, and you usually don't spend 30 hours on a home trainer, not as an elite cyclist either. Or some do, of course. So anything else we need to point out?
Yeah, so they're quite you're right, you know, 6.3 watts per kilos, you know, that's certainly beyond many of us. I'm interested, and maybe I didn't pick this up in my reading of it. Was it outdoor that they actually did this training?
No, we did everything indoors.
Everything indoors. So you had it
very. Yeah, so it was a bit difficult to to recruit people to do it because 4 hours on in the laboratory, sitting on a load Excalibur bike. does not sound that intimidating.
Yeah. Okay. Of course, you know, that is certainly something in terms of, you one of your stimuluses was to try and make it a little bit more less boring, let's say, the training. And certainly 4 hours on an indoor trainer is very boring if you're sitting at a constant intensity. I suppose that's where we all need YouTube or something like that to keep us.
Swift or
but yeah. Okay, so these 12 cyclists, what sort of tests did you do at the beginning, apart from sort of just profiling? What sort of things?
We did a lactate profile, and we did a wind gait test, which is a 30-second all-out sprint, not a maximal sprint, all-out sprint, all they can do. And then we did the lactate profile, which is 5 minutes at, for instance, 175 watts, do a lactate, 5 minutes more on 225. So we increase 50 watts every 5 minutes until we reach a level above 4 millimoles of lactate. And that is usually above what you would say lactate threshold or maximal lactate steady state, and all those threshold measures, as we say. So we just use that because it's comparable over time.
Okay. And so I suppose I'm going to come back to it in a moment, but I was interested in what you said there about all out versus maximal. And I think, having, as I said to you earlier, I have read 6 papers over the last few days on sprint interval training in preparation for examining a PhD. But and because that interested me in terms of when any type of interval training, let's say, is how hard is the work period and so on. So I think we'll come back to that, how maybe that compares the 30-second sprints that your riders did compared to their all-out test.
Yeah.
And maybe what the implications are, the practical implications around that. Mm. The 4 hours that they did on this indoor trainer, you know, how did you decide what that intensity would be?
Well, we looked just to the literature and try to figure out, okay, what would a typical low intensity session be? It needs to be something that they can endure. And that could be a normal four-hour session. So it shouldn't be that strenuous, but it should also not be too easy. So we just ended on landed on the power output at 50% of VO2 max. So this is in the fresh state we get from the lactate profile. We have all different intensities up to maximal to the VO2 max, and we do okay at 50% of VO2 max. How much power are you doing there? And we put them on that. So that's below or around 200 watts for these guys. So that would be an easy low intensity session for a cyclist.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, I suppose it's maybe you can't answer this question. You know, I wondered, how would that have compared to what they would have done anyway? You know, if you'd have said to them, I want you to do a low intensity, do you think, you know, this is how they would have perceived it? Or if they, you know, if the coach had told them to go out on the road and do that, is they would have come back with this at roughly 200, do you think?
It would translate to around 2.6 watts per kilo approximately. And I would guess a normal cyclist doing a long ride would also do something between three watts per kilo, I guess, on a long session. Yeah.
Okay. So they're on their indoor trainer. They've got this 4 hours at roughly 50% of VO2 max. But then on top of that, you're going to give them some 30-second sprints. Just explain how that fits into your protocol.
Yeah. So we, of course, wanted to compare with a normal, just low intensity session. So these guys visit us two times. Once when they only did 4 hours at 50% of VO2 max, just flat, keeping the same power output, eating a lot of carbohydrates as much as they wanted. And then they came back. This was, of course, in a randomized manner, but not as necessarily that important for this talk. But when they came back, they did the same session, but three times each hour, we included three 30-second sprints. So three 30-second sprints the first hour, three the next, and three on the third. We did not do sprints in the fourth hour. So totally nine 30-second sprints in these 3 hours.
Okay. And so they, you know, obviously I've looked at the paper, they come nearer the end of the hour. Remind me, there is obviously a little bit of a gap between the 30-second sprints. So how long was there between the 30-second sprints?
It was 4 hours of recovery. Sorry, 4 minutes between each 30-second sprint. Yeah, not four. Yeah. So they had 1 minute where they just sat still, just hyperventilating. And then they just rode at 100 watts something for 3 minutes. And then they did the next sprint. So when we did the same kind of protocol outside as well on the training camp with another group of elite cyclists. And in the field, you're sprinting all you can, then you just stop, try to stay on the bike and just keep on rolling. And then as soon as you begin to catch your breath, you just start pedaling very, very lightly just to wash out the lactate or whatever we should say.
Okay, great. Okay, so we know the protocol. So 4 hours, and within that, we get three blocks of three 30-second sprints separated by 4 minutes of recovery.
Exactly.
And then what sort of measurements were you taking throughout that as well?
So the main focus of this was to find out how does the inclusion of sprints affect, for instance, the efficiency, so the gross efficiency. Does it decrease the efficiency more than just riding low and slow? We wanted to see that. we also wanted to see how does it affect the muscular activation. So we did the EMG measurements, and we also wanted to see the pedaling technique, have a look at the pedaling technique, because it might be that there was a connection between a change in gross efficiency and a change in pedaling technique. So they are becoming less efficient in the pedaling. So we wanted to compare those as well. And lastly, we also, of course, wanted to compare, could they actually do the same power outputs on the sprints and on all of those three sets, or do they fatigue gradually when they repeat sprints? So hopefully a lot of take-home messages from this.
Okay. So gross efficiency, it's hugely important, isn't it, for cyclists?
Indeed. Indeed. Of course, if you're less efficient, you're wasting much more energy. So
I suppose we should say it's probably more important for runners, because I think the variability across individuals is much higher in running, but because cycling is a closed skill. But I think the research is pretty clear in terms of those really elite cyclists that have been in the lab, you know, generally demonstrate much, much better efficiency, and therefore, and I suppose the other thing for me, and I know there's been some work done on this, you know, Louis Passfield and James Hocker, etc., have looked at specifically changes in efficiency
over time.
And I suspect, you know, while we're still gathering more information, I suspect that it's highly individual how that might change over time based on what activity you're doing. So it is really important.
Indeed. In terms of difference between elite athletes and non-elite athletes, it's not as clear as it is for untrained people. Elite athletes, of course, have a better gross efficiency than untrained athletes. But when you're comparing just a good cyclist with an elite cyclist, I don't think we see that big of a difference. But some of the difference may lay in how they maintain their gross efficiency as they gradually fatigue. And that is one of the implications of these papers published.
Because the other thing as well is, I think the literature's would seem to suggest that certainly at higher intensity, that decline in, because we generally get a decline in efficiency over a prolonged exercise period, but that decline is greater as the intensity goes up, as well as it being inter-individual. So if you're a competitive cyclist and you want to have a sprint at the end, or want to be able to exercise hard at the end in particular, the more efficient that you are, the more likelihood that's going to be possible. And as you alluded to there, one of the measures that you were interested in was the maintenance of your 30-second sprint over the period of time, which could be crucial tactically within a race scenario.
Okay, so we should look at the gross efficiency first. What is, as you say, the gross efficiency decreases when you're exercising for a prolonged period. And we find that regardless of whether you recruit sprints or not. So in a 4-hour session, just riding at 50% of VO2 max, 200 watts, say, you decrease around 1 percentage point in gross efficiency. And usually we measure gross efficiency around 19%. So translate that into something else, 81% of the energy you're actually spending is not you spent on bringing you forward.
Pushing the pedals, that's right.
Yeah. So a lot of energy is wasted. But cycling is one of the most efficient ways of movement. So that's it's still good.
Yeah.
But regardless of sprinting, you decrease the gross efficiency. As I mentioned, our main question was, of course, does inclusion of sprints has any effect on that? And we did not see any difference when you compare the two conditions, just ride low and slow or include sprints. after 4 hours. So they end up at the same point, 1 percentage point lower. What we did see, though, is that it seems that after the first set of sprints, you have the majority of the decrease appears after the first set of sprints. And then you're a bit lower and you keep lower, but you eventually you end up at the same point. So it might seem that you decrease faster when you do sprints in the beginning, but it does not have a negative effect at the end, though.
Very interesting. Very interesting, because I suppose that's, you know, as I said earlier, obviously intensity, just a constant intensity, that the relative level of that does impact on the changes in efficiency over a prolonged period of time. But maybe there's some indication of a mechanism there that's could be the same result from a different mechanism, of course, but ultimately, yeah. So we have that decline after the first set of sprints, but we don't at the end, we're the same as we would be if we just kept this constant intensity.
Yeah. So if we should go a bit into that. One of our thoughts was that when you sprint, you engage your type 2 fibers. And we know that the type 2 fibers are less efficient than the type 1s, and they fatigue way faster than type 1s. So some of our thoughts were, okay, if we fatigue some of the type 2 fibers, maybe they require some attention, you could say. They need recovery in the period afterwards. And it's important to say that when we measure the gross efficiency, we don't measure the gross efficiency just after the sprints. Of course, you will have an EPOC, you will have a high oxygen uptake because you need an instant recovery. But we measure this actually 40 minutes after they did the sprint set. So this is not immediately after, this is good time after, where they actually say that, oh, no, I'm feeling fine. The RPE is back to normal at that moment, but they seem to be less efficient, though.
But of course, I think it's a good point you make in terms of the 50% intensity potentially would allow recovery of those type 2 during that period of time, but there would be a slight oxygen cost for that recovery. So that may be an explanation.
But you would expect 40 minutes after that, they are recovered, those type 2 fibers.
Yeah.
And we as I mentioned, we also did the EMG measures. And you can look at the firing frequency there. That's what determines whether you engage the type 1 or type 2 fibers. And we did not see any change in the spectrum there. So we are not recruiting type 2 fibers when we are riding at low intensity. So that is not the reason why we have a high oxygen uptake and hence a lower gross efficiency when you're riding low and slow. But of course we cannot entirely say that the type 2 fibers are fully recovered, and that is why we see a difference. But
obviously, you know, you mentioned the EMG there, and it wasn't different between the two conditions. But the other thing that you looked at was your pedaling technique. So what you did find some small differences here, isn't that right?
Yeah, we did.
So how does that? I'm just, you know, if the EMG is exactly the same or as sensitively as you can measure, but you have...
We did see some small differences between the two conditions in the EMG. On the general basis, we saw an increase in EMG, which just reflects the lower efficiency. Although those two changes did not correlate that well, but this is some of the difficulties with the EMG measure, especially during long periods. You tend to lose connection. So It's very difficult to do these kind of measures. So we did see a similar pattern, but statistically some small differences between the two. But with regards to the pedaling technique, we saw a decrease in mechanical effectiveness. And we only saw that in the sprint group. But on the other hand, we saw a greater increase in EMG in the control situation. So it's kind of the same story, different scenarios, kind of explanation.
I'm glad you brought up the increasing EMG. I must admit, it was something I was going to mention and forgot to, or I didn't remember. For our listeners, it's I'll use a term that one of my lecturers when I was an undergraduate, who was interested in muscle fatigue, used to use, and he called it flogging the failing horse. So you know, this is the central drive, essentially realizing that muscles are fatiguing. So the only way that it can try and maintain that intensity is obviously to increase the signal to the muscles. So it's quite common for EMG to rise in these types of scenarios. It did cross my mind to ask you the question about measuring EMG over a prolonged period of time, and I thought this might be too technical for our listeners, but having done some of this myself, it is really, really difficult to maintain a consistent measurement of EMG over a prolonged exercise period of time. And I think for me, the worry has always been is the capacitance over, you know, where the measurement site, and depends obviously what type of electrode, and I've experimented with different types of electrodes over the years, but I don't know that there is an easy answer to this. And it does in many ways inhibit our understanding maybe of electrically exactly what's happening within the muscles. You know, your only other option, presumably, obviously, you had electrodes that were in place for the whole period of the exercise, and because the only other option is to replace them. But again, that is full of potential error.
Yeah, then you get the measurement error because they're not situated at the exact same point. Yeah. And what you usually do is you refer to some kind of maximal effort. To begin with, and say how much percentage is this signal compared to a maximal engagement, and you mess that up if you move them. So what we low key did was just put the electrodes under the cycling, the bibs, the shorts, and that kept it rather in place. But of course, they sweat a lot, and sometimes we lost signal because of that.
But it's the best that we can do. It gives us an indication that okay, there were sort of minor, well, there's changes over the period of time for both groups, not such a big difference between the groups potentially as we can tell. Did I pick up correctly? There wasn't a relationship. Well, you said there wasn't a relationship between the change in the EMG and efficiency. What about the relationship between changes in the EMG and pedaling technique? Was there a relationship between those two?
I actually don't think I did that comparison.
Okay.
I only compared it with the gross efficiency because that was our main focus. We wanted to explain the change in gross efficiency because that was what we knew from before, so we wanted to explain what is it that makes us less efficient. So I actually didn't compare those.
Of course, it's, you know, the issue would be is that it's not just necessarily, if you like, the gross signal, it's the timing of the signal. So unless you have some way of time aligning EMG across the muscle groups, I think then the relationship to the technique is slightly more difficult. And I know I've tried this in the past with a study that we did looking at different crank systems trying to time align EMG to pedaling over a period of time is extremely difficult.
Yeah, I know that one of my co-authors on this paper, Gertjan Ettenbach, is from Trondheim, the NTNU university, and they do a lot of that also in cross-country skiing. And I'm like, they are, yeah, it's a difficult job, but they are brilliant in performing these kind of studies and
so
with the calculations.
So we've gone through, you know, all of the different measures and essentially what the findings are. Do you want to just in a couple of sentences just summarize, so what was the findings?
Yeah, so I would say from this that regardless whether you include sprints or not, you end up at the same point gross efficiency wise. You decrease your gross efficiency by around 1 percentage point after 4 hours. It could seem that when you perform sprints in the beginning of a session, you get a faster decrease in the gross efficiency. Hence, it would cost you more during that session. We saw the mirror measurements for the EMG, that when the gross efficiency decreases, you have to engage more of your muscle to produce the same power output. And we also saw that the mechanical effectiveness was decreased generally. So some part of the explanation was also that they changed their pedaling technique a bit, become less efficient as they gradually fatigue. And the last point from this is that when you repeat the three sets of sprints and you compare the mean power output on those three sprints in each set, you don't see a difference from the first to the second or the third. So they are able to just do the same power on the third hour.
And of course, I'll roll back to, I suppose, the question that, or the point I made earlier, is that the absolute power in each of these 30-second sprints in comparison to that all out, there is a fair difference, isn't there? If I remember correctly from the tables, you know, the all outs were in the region of what, 1200 and above. In fact, no, the average was 16.
That's a peak power.
Oh, the peak. Yeah. Oh, sorry. The mean was 800. Yes. Sorry. I see that.
Yeah.
And then in the actual, it's more in the 700. Was it in the actual? Is that?
Yeah, but when you combine all three sprints, you're around, for the first set, you are around 780 watts and decreasing ish to 760 watts in the third set. So difference in the mean of 20 watts.
Yeah. Okay.
Between those two.
Still pretty good.
No, it's not much. Actually, they are recovering pretty well when they are riding at 50%. They can do the same again.
Of course, we have
this also says something about these elite cyclists. They recover very fast. Yeah. We actually just recently published a paper where we dive more into this on and compare the aerobic and the anaerobic systems during these sprints, how that changes when you repeat sprints. Jim might also look into that.
Let's come to that in a second. I think you made a really good point there, and I suppose it's important to for our listeners, is that, you know, these are good quality athletes. You and I, if we tried this, we may not be able to replicate the 9 sprints quite as well as they would be. However, it's something that you know is a reflection on ability and fitness. So it may be something that one should strive to try and do. So I suppose coming back to sort of the practical findings of this particular study is that it is possible to put these 9 sprints in here. You can maintain, as long as you've got the fitness, you can maintain the quality of, mm-hmm. of those sprints, and it doesn't negatively impact on gross efficiency in this case. So you can complete this endurance ride with these 9 sprints, and it doesn't seemingly adversely affect the workout at all. I suppose the next question then is to move on to and broaden it out a little bit into some of your other work. Why would we want to put these sprints in here anyway, apart from changing the boredom aspect? There may be some other reasons that we want to put it 9 sprints in there. What would those be?
Yeah, as I mentioned in the beginning, there are some several implications for why we should include sprints in those sessions, or just in training of elite cyclists generally. We know from the vast studies that Van Aert and Sanders and Peter Leo has done, where they looked at the maximal mean power outputs in competitions, and they find that the maximal mean power you can produce for shorter periods, so everything below 5 minutes, that is what is the most important part for professional cyclists. So those who win, they are the guys who produce most power at 5 minutes and below. And what we know from previous studies in sprint training, we know that if it really has an effect on something, it's the short duration performances. So just based on that, you should really focus on the shorter durations as well, and especially in the gradually fatiguing state, because that is where the races are won. They're not won in the fresh state. So repeating sprints during a long session, that will gradually fatigue you. And as you mentioned, the quality, maybe we should discuss that, but you gradually fatigue doing sprints, and you're probably going into something that is very important, very specific for the cycling competitions, because you should be able to repeat the same power output at the end of the race. And they actually find that when they compare the first week of the Vuelta or the Tour de France and the third week, they are more or less able to produce the same power outputs, these professional cyclists. And that is just by extremely hard work for so many hours that they can resist that fatigue. So just take it back to where just including sprints and long sessions is highly relevant, just for competition wise, I would say.
And I suppose part of your description there has been around what we see in professional cyclists, what we know, having measured professional cyclists. Do we know at a physiological level, because that's the outcome, what's the physiological effect of including these sprints, which allows us to be able to replicate nearly the same sprint power at the end? Do we know?
I did a couple of studies on that, both during the off season and during the preparatory period in different scenarios. And just shortly summarizing that, we don't find any effects on measures in the fresh state. So including sprints in the off season or during a training camp, for instance, it does not affect the threshold. It does not affect the maximal mean power output, does not affect the VO2 max. Of course, it improves your sprint performance. You would expect that. But what I think is the most important is that we also did, at the end of all our measurements, we also did either a 5-minute time trial or a 20-minute time trial. So this is done in the fatigue state. They are they are at their limit when they reach that. It's done after the four 30-second sprints. so they are pretty wasted. But what we did find when they included sprints in a training period, they improved the 5-minute power output, or they improved the 20-minute power output compared to if you didn't include the sprints. So it does seem to have some implications on your performance in the fatigue state.
Good old muscle fatigue. And because we, you know, there's so much about muscle fatigue that we do not understand. We can describe what's happening, but, you know, physiologically, we actually don't understand what the mechanism is there. But I think that's extremely interesting in terms of, you know, the practical sort of implications for you know, anybody trying to improve their performance, that it's not obvious from fresh tests. It's only if you do these pre-post and a fatiguing element in between that you can actually determine what the outcome. And of course, I think you said earlier, in terms of race outcomes, you know, this is the most important bit, is about what do you have left near the end of the race in many cases, that allows you to be able to be competitive and to win.
Indeed. And also on top of that, we did talk about gross efficiency, and what we also tend to find when you have a longer period, training period, where you include sprints, is that the decrease in gross efficiency becomes less when you include sprints. So you maintain your gross efficiency at a higher level when you fatigue. It could seem like that, but if we should bear in mind, this is, we only have a handful, two handfuls of cyclists we did this on. So it's not that clear, but I think we do see some tendencies that it might also have a positive effect on maintaining the gross efficiency at a higher level. That could be some of the explanation. Another explanation for why they have a better performance in the fatigue state is also the fact that they're pushing at a higher level of maximal oxygen uptake. They are at a higher fraction of the maximal oxygen uptake. So whether it's just because they are in beta shape, or if they are actually more used to doing maximal efforts, it's difficult to say. But the fact is that they are at a higher fraction of maximal oxygen uptake when they do the 5 or 20 minute time trials.
Okay, good. It's probably a little bit cruel to ask, because, you know, we probably don't have the data, but, you know, I did explore a little bit in terms of the app, you know, I called it the quality, but, you know, the intensity of each of these 30 seconds, you know, they were flat out, pretty close to flat out. How intense does that need to be? Do we just need to be, if you like, and I'll just use the term, into the extreme domain, or does it really need to be flat out? What, you know, I'm just trying to judge, you know, what is the stimulus here? Does it really, really need to be flat out? Because I'm just trying to, again, I got my practical head on, and how does this feel for somebody going out? You know, I think most of us can reach into the extreme domain reasonably easy, but to actually go out and do proper 30 seconds, many of us who've been in a lab and done wind gate tests, you know, 30 seconds is not a pleasant experience if you're doing it absolutely flat out. So I'm just curious, if we can get into the extreme domain, is that enough, do you think?
I think it's a very good question, and it's a question we often ask. And just if we change the focus a bit, if you compare the effects of, for instance, resistance training, and you compare higher loads, smaller loads, lots of reps. And as I see it, it only comes down to, do they push themselves to the degree of fatigue that they are not able to do another rep? That is a maximal effort. And that is where you see the greatest gains in strength training. To me, if you don't push the limit on the sprints, you won't get the same effect. But we do not have any evidence of that, because no one has compared what if you only do 80% of what you are able to do for the 30-second sprint. No one has done it, so we cannot say it. But I'm pretty convinced that if you don't push yourself to the limit here, you won't get the gains in the end. And that is pretty much the end point here. Okay. When that said, we touched upon it earlier that the difference between a maximal sprint and an all-out sprint. The definition of an all-out sprint is that you open as hard as you possibly can and you leave everything on the bike. So you're not able to do anything. So the curve is just a peak in the first seconds, and then it's just decreasing until your legs barely go around. That is an all-out. If a cyclist know that they are going to do 3 sprints or 9 or 12 sprints, that's not an all-out. It's not the same, because just by knowing that you need to do this again, you come very close to your all-out, but it's per definition not an all-out. It's a maximal effort. So they push as much as they can, and I can assure you, I have some of the guys really go above the limits, but it's a maximal effort, and that's the difference between it. When you repeat it, it cannot be an all-out. It is a maximal effort.
Yeah, I think we all have that central governor in there that when we know that we have to repeat,
save some for later.
There is a lot of literature around central governor, and I think it's just, you know, the brain is pretty clever. When you tell it that it has to do 9 of these, it isn't going to empty itself on the first one.
No, it's pretty difficult, but. In terms of power, if you have someone, if you want to take home, you have to do around 90 to 95%. That is where we usually end up when you compare the means of these repeated sprints with a 1 all-out sprint. So do all you can. But as you stay, we also used quality of the sprint without altering quality of the sprints. And I actually don't like that definition, because is it good quality because you can maintain the power output? In my head, a good quality is that you get as much out of the sprint as you can possibly do. And when you're doing a maximal sprint, and really this is your maximal effort, that is a high quality sprint. But just because if the mean power output of the first sprint is 800 and the mean power output of the last sprint is 600, but you're still doing a 20 RPE sprint, then it's good quality. That is a quality to me. So just because you are fatiguing, it doesn't mean that it's a less quality. It just means that you're tired.
Yes. I suppose, I know you hinted at it earlier, and I know it's something I'll be asking this PhD candidate this afternoon, is, the first sprint in terms of the metabolic demand is completely different than the metabolic demand of the final sprint.
Indeed.
What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Just if you're thinking about what are the glycogen storages, for instance, when you begin the first sprint compared to the last sprint, these are completely different, of course, because sprinting is what really decreases your glycogen stores. we did try to do something to at least maintain some of the Clackerton stores. So they ate and drank as much carbohydrate as they could and wanted to, and we just did the same in the two sessions. So we wanted to mimic something that is comparable to what a cyclist would do outside. And usually if you're on a 4-hour ride, you will also drink energy drinks and have gels. So unfortunately we didn't measure the glycogen storages in these samples. I wanted to, but we didn't have enough tissue to do that. But it would be interesting to see and compare.
But I suspect, you know, I would love to look at the kinetics, or you know, around this, because you know, my view is that, you know, that you, the first one is a lot more anaerobically based, energy system based, than the last one. I'm being very general here, because I'm kind of moving on to interval training per se, and of course there's the huge variety of work rest ratios, etc. But I suppose what I'm trying to get across, I think it's a huge misconception to believe that, you know, the metabolic demand that the body experiences from your first sprint is going to be the same as the metabolic demand that your body experiences in the final sprint, despite what even the power output might be.
Yeah. When you say that we expect that the anaerobic percentage of the power of a sprint would be much higher in the first sprint compared to the second sprint, I also thought that, but that thought is actually based on a lot of the research that's done in the 80s and 90s. And that is not done in elite cyclists. That is done in normally healthy males, not trained. And we actually tried to compare this, because we did oxygen measurements when they repeated these sprints. So we had a gross efficiency before and after, so we could fairly accurately estimate how much of the energy they spent comes from the aerobic source, the oxygen uptake, and how much is left. That would be the anaerobic. And I just sent the latest paper we published here in 21, where we compared the aerobic and anaerobic contributions on these repeated sprints. And what is the anaerobic part in the first sprint is not hugely different. It's not much higher on the first sprint compared to the second and the third. They are actually able to maintain quite a lot of the anaerobic power when they repeat the sprints. As we said earlier, they are able to recover quite fast when they get 4 minutes of recovery between sprints.
Okay, very interesting. I look forward to reading that, and I'll post that in our in the show notes, and I'm sure our listeners can go and have a little look at that for themselves. And of course, you know, maybe I'm being slightly selfish here in my questions. You know, having read your original paper, of course, as a coach myself, you know, I'd go out and let me try this in my own training rides.
Yeah,
I'm thinking, am I trying hard enough in these 30-second sprints? Maybe I'm going to have to try harder. Maybe I'm not doing all out. So, it's, Nicky, thanks for that. You've just made my 30 seconds harder.
Well, you're welcome. Just remember, before I subjected anybody to this, I actually did this myself. So I would know what it would feel like. And this is also a part of my own training throughout the season. But I would recommend if people should start out with this session, don't start out with a 4-hour session and 12 sprints. Just start out with 6 sprints and just experience how is that, and see, okay, that was pretty tough. And it is. Then after, if you've done that for 2-3 sessions, you can try to increase it to 9 sprints. And then gradually you're getting used to it. And that's what we found in one of the studies from the training camp, that the first session, the guys rated quite strenuous. This was a hard one. But they did total of 5 sessions where they included 12 to 30-second sprints. And they gradually decreased the RPE, the session RPE after each session. And eventually they ended up on the 5th session, they rated it as hard as the control group who just rode low and slow. And in my own experience, I do say it's quite the same. You get used to it. It's not that it's not hard. It is hard, but you get used to it and it becomes much easier. So the first session is definitely the hardest.
Yeah, I think I normally just interspace sort of 30-second sprints in convenient parts of my normal training route. So I suppose, you know, a takeaway message for any riders that are listening is that, you know, there does seem to be good evidence that incorporating these 30-second sprints into your longer endurance ride, okay, makes it less boring. There are no physiological downsides, if you like, from doing it, and there are potential benefits in terms of your overall performance and in particular, possibly maintenance of efficiency over time.
I think it's important to mention, I also guess a lot of listeners are asking, but what about recovery? To the next day, is that effective when you include these sprints? And we evaluated recovery using the maximal peak torque, the peak torque. So it's a leg extension of the thigh muscle, so you can see how much force can they produce. And after the 4-hour session, this is of course decreased. And when we measured it again 3 hours after, we did see that the low intensity session, they were fully recovered after 3 hours, whereas the sprint group was not quite there. But when we compared it again 24 hours later, so the next day you would do the next session, we did see that they were back to the same level as when they did the low intensity session. So that indicates at least that the recovery of the muscle strength is full.
Because the other important thing is for, and maybe not all of our listeners are in, if you like, the road race type competitive events. But if you are, the other added benefit is that this is the type of training that's most likely to enhance your opportunity to be competitive, to be in those moves, to create those moves in the actual race itself. So that's really important. So fantastic. Nikki, thank you very much for a really engaging discussion. I know I've enjoyed it greatly, even though I now need to go and modify my own training. Thank you. So I obviously if our listeners want to sort of catch up with you directly, I'm sure they'll catch up with you at University of Copenhagen. I know you're listed on ResearchGate, so I'm sure they could catch up with you there. Do you have a Twitter handle?
Yes, I do have a Twitter handle, and that's Almqvist Nikki. Okay. So my name is a bit weird because my mother's side is English and my father's side was a Swedish name. So it's Winfield Almqvist. It's a bit bit of a mess up, and I'm Danish, so I have a Norwegian girlfriend, so yeah, Viking in all the way.
truly international.
But Twitter handle Elmquist Nikki.
Okay, fantastic. I suppose what's you know, your postdoctoral researcher at Copenhagen, what do you do? What's your current work? What are you interested in at the moment?
So I continued in the well-trained athletes department, you could say, but changed the focus of training physiology into nutrition instead. So I'm leading a study at the moment where we investigate the effects of altering the macronutrient composition for well-trained triathletes and cyclists.
Fantastic. Again, I look forward to getting you back on again, then, Nikki, to talk about that. That's obviously a topic that's close to many of our hearts in terms of, you know, there is a huge range of different nutritional products out there. And, you know, in some cases, the science behind it is maybe not as strong as it could or should be. So while we're maybe not all elite athletes, we would always like to find out what's the latest findings there. So thank you very much, Nikki, for your time, and I say all the best in that new position that you have, relatively new, and the research team that you're leading there. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Richard. Nice discussion, and hopefully someone will have some good take-home messages from this. Otherwise, just reach out.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and of course I need to thank Nikki for giving up his time for the podcast. If you want to find out more, then I've included some more details on the show website on cycling-science.com. Of course, I also need to recognise my employers, the University of West of Scotland, and if you'd like to find out a bit more about the courses we offer and the research we do, then please visit our website, uws.ac.uk. Remember, if you've got any questions you'd like us to answer in a future show, then please contact us through our website. That is, again, cycling-science.com. Also, if you'd like any professional advice or coaching from me, then please also use the contact page on our website or even through our Facebook page. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and of course I need to thank Nikki for giving up his time for the podcast. If you want to find out more, then I've included some more details on the show website on cycling-science.com. Of course, I also need to recognise my employers, the University of West of Scotland, and if you'd like to find out a bit more about the courses we offer and the research we do, then please visit our website, uws.ac.uk. Remember, if you've got any questions you'd like us to answer in a future show, then please contact us through our website. That is, again, cycling-science.com. Also, if you'd like any professional advice or coaching from me, then please also use the contact page on our website or even through our Facebook page. Until next time, thanks for listening. Remember, good scientists and coaches always seek out quality evidence to back up the work. So never just accept what you read or hear. Seek quality sources to inform your training and racing.